It's coming up. There you go.
Your Holiness, it's an honor to be here with you again and to be with this wonderful group of people addressing these questions. And I hope to see whether there is something we can learn from the Western traditions that we have developed of altering consciousness and attention with the great experience that you and the Buddhist tradition have of doing it. And also to address the question that comes from the distress that Dr. Holland talked about, what can we do about it, and what is the connection between addressing the distress and having an effect on the body as well. So the question you asked is exactly the one that I would like to address with you. And I would like to do it in addressing three issues. What we do in support groups for cancer patients. We started some 40 years ago bringing women together who had life-threatening illness and having them share their experience and discuss it. And I will describe what the intervention was. I'll talk about how we use hypnosis to alter pain. And one area where I might disagree is actually you can change the level of pain, the physical pain that you experience using hypnosis. And the third area is then what effects do these interventions have on the actual physical health of the patient. When we met in 2005, you made a comment that has had me thinking ever since and I think was very important. We were talking about suffering at the time. And we were talking about why might it be that engaging with someone else's suffering when you have plenty of suffering on your own would be helpful rather than harmful. And what you said was, in the case of experiencing our own suffering, there is an element of involuntariness, in fact, a lack of freedom. And when you empathize with someone else's suffering, when you embrace others' suffering, there is a voluntary dimension. In fact, that kind of voluntary action comes on the basis of a choice and also on the basis of a freedom. Because of this, you have a freedom in that also the experience may be painful, but it is qualitatively different from experiencing your own pain. So we have used that wonderful thought of yours to try to understand how we can work with cancer patients in sharing their own pain and suffering, but in a way that is constructive and helpful to them. Many cancer patients suffer with problems like depression, feeling hopeless, helpless, and worthless. And this leaves them in the opposite position from the one you described, where they turn inward. They feel isolated and unworthy. They don't engage with other people. And they don't feel they control their own mental state. Their brain is in a kind of loop where it keeps pointing out the negative and they cannot experience the positive. We have found that this state of depression actually predicts poorer outcome with breast cancer. So on this slide, and I'll have a number of slides like this that are called survival curves, where you see over time how many people die in each group. As the line goes down, more people die. And what you see here in the yellow line is people whose depression at the beginning was getting worse, many years later died sooner compared to those whose depression was getting better. So depression alone is a risk factor for mortality with breast cancer, independent of all the other known risk factors for mortality with breast cancer. What we try to do is help people who feel damaged with breast cancer move from this sense of being mutilated by the disease and its treatment to find a way to transcend it. And when you look at the winged victory of Samothrace on the right, you don't look at it and say, there's a woman who's missing her head and her arms. You see it as an image of transcendence. So how can people do this? So the way we try to address the problems facing these patients in support groups is to address their sense of being isolated by themselves to building new bonds of commitment. And it's very interesting to see how quickly people with the same illness come together and feel a tremendous sense of community and belonging. There's also, your illness becomes an advantage. It's not good to have cancer, but if you have learned something about how to cope with cancer, you then can give a gift to other members of the group in teaching them how to cope better with it. We encourage patients not to suppress their emotions, and I think there is much in the in the contemplative tradition about being open to whatever feelings come to you and let them blow through you. In a sense, we encourage patients to be open about the expression of their anger, fear, and sadness. Many patients think if I suppress how I feel about cancer, I'm somehow suppressing the cancer, and that is not true. So we encourage them to be emotionally open. We encourage them to face their anxiety about death rather than avoid it, to make it familiar, as you said in an earlier conference, rather than something that they run away from. And as Dr. Holland mentioned, it used to be that we wouldn't even talk about cancer, let alone death, with patients. We now know from decades of work that it helps rather than harms them to be able to face their own death and the death of other people, that they can see it from a different perspective in watching someone else, even though they grieve losses in these groups. Many patients wonder what's left in my life. If I can't have the life I had before, is there any meaning in it? And we encourage patients to reorder their life priorities and find new meaning in it. My mentor, Irvin Yalom, said cancer cures neurosis. You know, when you get that ill, you find ways to redefine meaning in your life. Families are tremendously stressed by cancer, and we encourage patients to communicate more clearly with their families, have them talk about their own fears and concerns. Many patients feel helpless in participating in their medical treatment, and we encourage them to take more control, to communicate better with their doctors. And the seventh thing we do is we use what is our Western meditative tradition of teaching them self-hypnosis to control their consciousness and their pain. So let me tell you a bit about what we found in these groups. When one woman was dying, a member made these cards and circulated them to other members, said, "Dear Eva, whenever the wind is from the sea, salty and strong, you are here. Remembering your zest for hilltops and the sturdy surf of your laughter gentles my grief at your going and tempers the thought of my own." So they found themselves comforted by facing even the deaths of other members in the group. We found that we could reduce their tendency to suppress emotions, so they became more open to their own feelings. That's this black line going down here, that they were more open to how they felt. And despite being more open to their anger, fear, and sadness, they actually became less anxious and depressed over time. So this was a randomized clinical trial. Half the patients... Half the patients participated in the support group, the yellow line. In the green line, the ones who did not, and they became less anxious and depressed, especially to the extent that they could stop suppressing their negative emotions. So giving vent to them actually helped reduce their overall distress. Then we taught them self-hypnosis to help them control their pain. And here, Your Holiness, I would differ a bit in what you said about the pain in your arm. I'm sure it's gone by now. Hypnosis can help people actually alter the pain experience itself, so they can literally learn to feel less pain. And it has a kind of focused attention. You mentioned a meditative practice of specific focus. Hypnosis is like what a telephoto lens is to a camera. You see what you see in the center of your consciousness with great detail. You're less aware of what's going on outside that central focus. So you control the context of experience, focus intently, and you are more likely to respond uncritically to suggestion, to what people tell you. So you can change your experience in a rather marked way. And we have found specific regions in the brain that are involved with the ability to experience hypnosis. And two of them that work together are what's called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex on the left here and the anterior cingulate gyrus, the dorsal part of it here.
His Holiness is wondering how the decrease in the actual experience of the pain works here. Is it the case that less attention is paid to the experience of pain and therefore you feel less acute pain, or is it literally decreasing the actual experience of the pain itself?
This is a very important question, and the answer is, in some ways, both happen. Mm-hmm. So part of it is that the brain reacts differently, and that's actually this region here, the anterior cingulate cortex here. You can turn down the amount of attention you pay to the pain. But to our initial surprise, the other possibility you mentioned also occurs. So they actually reduce the response of parts of the brain, like the somatosensory cortex that records pain experiences and deeper structures that do. You actually reduce the pain experience itself. So they literally feel less pain, and it doesn't bother them as much. Two parts of the brain are involved.
So how does that compare to the mechanism of pain, painkillers?
It's a very interesting question, and we studied that. So we looked at the effects of opiates, for example, because there are what are called endogenous opiate receptors in the brain that help us control pain, as the opiates do. It turns out it's a different mechanism, that you can block the effect of opiates and still get hypnotic analgesia. So it's a top-down effect. It's not a bottom-up effect.
So because it's a top-down approach, there's also a biochemical processes involved?
We think there are, and we're just trying to figure them out now, but we know that one neurotransmitter seems to be involved, and that is dopamine. Dopamine is a prominent neurotransmitter in these particularly frontal regions in the brain. And there is evidence that people who are more responsive to hypnosis have higher dopamine activity in the brain. And there's even some genetic studies now that show that people with a certain kind of polymorphism in a gene that produces dopamine tend to be more responsive to hypnosis.
Does it vary according to age, the effect of this?
It does in this sense. Children are the most hypnotizable of humans. So all 8-year-olds are in trances all the time. So
His Holiness was wondering, because you know, when you're very generally speaking, children are still in the very active process of growth.
Yes.
So maybe there's less, you know, His Holiness was thinking it would be the opposite, because you know, when you're older, then you have much greater activity of kind of regulation, cognitive control. So maybe this effect could be more pronounced in the adults.
Well, it's a very good question, and for many adults, that is true. Many adults retain their hypnotizability throughout their adult life. But the interesting thing is that for children, work is play and play is work. So the two regions of the brain that you see here that involve how we carry out a task and deciding what task is important, that's what these two regions do, work together. And in a sense, there's something childlike about the hypnotic experience that some people retain into adult life as well.
Will there be a difference in the hypnotizability between morning and evening in the same
Morning
the same
and evening,
person?
No, I don't think so, unless you're really sleepy. there is no difference in morning and evening. It's an interesting question, but no.
Okay.
More confused. Okay.
So David is going to just relatively quickly
move
through.
So we have found that we can change the pain experience of cancer patients, teaching them self-hypnosis and providing group support. So the green line shows that by the end of the year, The breast cancer patients who were taught this had half the pain that the control group did on the same medication. So it's very effective. So the final question that I'll address briefly is, so what effect does this have potentially on not just how well they live, but on how long they live? And we published a paper in 1989 showing, to our surprise, that women who were randomly assigned with advanced breast cancer to these support groups lived on average a year and a half longer than control patients. And you see that here in this survival curve, whereby 4 years... So by 4 years after the study began, all of the controls had died and a third of the treatment group were still alive. It was a big effect. We tried to repeat this 20 years later in another study. We did not see the overall effect, but we think it was because the nature of breast cancer treatment had improved. So there were new hormonal treatments, but the patients who had a certain type of cancer, estrogen receptor negative cancer, who didn't benefit from the hormonal treatments, got the same benefit from being in the support group that allowed them to live longer than the controls. So we think the medical treatments had improved, but the ones who could not respond to the medical treatments did still benefit from the support group. Since then, there have been a number of other studies. There have been 15 randomized controlled trials. 8 of them show that psychotherapy actually improves survival time, and I'm very glad to say that none of them show that psychotherapy kills patients. There are none that show. So the 7 others show no difference. This is a study by Barbara Anderson at Ohio State showing that women randomly assigned with breast cancer to support groups live longer than control patients. And most recently, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine with patients dying of end-stage lung cancer. They were given palliative care, their depression was treated, their pain was treated, and the ones who got that lived 2.5 months longer than the control patients. So even at the very end of life, and I think especially when medical treatments are less effective, this kind of emotional support seems to be more effective. So the final comments are that we are trying in our tradition to cultivate compassion, help patients help one another, engage and transform pain and suffering, be open to suffering and distress, but transform it with techniques like hypnosis. And we now have evidence that feeling leads to healing. Thank you.